some students. We have students from Wayland Academy. Would they please stand? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. And we have some students from Gibraltar Schools. Would they stand, please? It's good seeing you here, too. Please be seated. The students are with us with a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And the program is called Court with Class. It is a national award-winning program, and we're very proud of it. We invite high schools from across the state to come join us for an oral argument. And if they accept, the schools have been given briefs of the case they're about to hear and may engage in various activities relating to the case. When they come here, they listen to oral argument and meet with a justice of this court after this argument. And they may be joined by students who came to the first oral argument. Anyone who wishes may join the students and the justice after this argument is over. The discussion will be on the processes the court uses in taking and hearing and deciding cases, not the substantive issues involved in the case. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. She is the justice with whom you'll meet today. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I am going to call the second case today, 03-1728 CR, State v. Alan J. Ernst. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Ernst is Attorney Jeffrey W. Jensen. Mr. Jensen.
Thank you. And if it pleases the court and Mr. Sanders, I am Jeffrey Jensen, and I represent Mr. Ernst in this case, who is the appellant. And since Justice Prosser made today a day for confessions, I have to confess that I spent a long time yesterday afternoon thinking about what I was going to say here today. And the longer and harder I thought about it, the more sweaty my palms got and the more my heart pounded, because I felt like a third grader preparing a 5-minute oral book report on a 10-page book. And I know there's no law that says I need to use up all 30 minutes, but I was afraid that I might not even use up a significant fraction of it.
Don't worry, we're going to help you.
But what scared me was that to me, it seems like the issue before the court today is about as clean and straightforward and as simple an issue as could be possible. And in looking through my briefs, I saw that of all the things I cited to and all of the arguments made, the one thing I forgot to cite to was the Fifth Amendment itself. And the Fifth Amendment says that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Now, that's a pretty simple and straightforward law. Even the Supreme Court's analysis or explanation of the meaning of that amendment is one sentence with three elements. It is the compulsion of testimony that incriminates. Again, a very simple law. And it was perplexing me how the fact that Alan Ernst, in his fourth offense drunk driving case in the year 2000, I think, the fact that he waived his right to remain silent and engaged in this colloquy with the judge and ended up pleading guilty, how the fact that he waived his right to remain silent in that case could be used to compel him to testify against himself in this case.
Well, can I, in order to stretch this out to 30 minutes, I'm going to ask a question that will probably get you off track right away.
Okay.
Now, we received two letter briefs. We received the state's and the, before we get into the real meat of the case, the question that I have involves Iowa versus Tovar, which was decided in March 2004 by the U.S. Supreme Court. Case, in, as you recall, this was the third drunk driving case in Iowa. And the similarity between that case and this case is that the words and language of where Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in a unanimous court indicated that there was no discussion of the words of whether Mr. Ernst being aware of difficulty and the disadvantages of self-representation. And that's where the judge said that the, let's say, the inquiry into his self-representation, pro se, that they missed the boat, they being the state, and he found that it was not valid. Okay? Right. Now, you say in your letter brief, in response, that we should not even consider this case because it was in March. This case took place before, and the state is asking, well, they're asking either that it be improvidently granted, or they're asking that we just look at Tovar and say, well, the law is clear that you don't have to ask that question.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Now, tell me why you think we should not consider that case.
Well, I recognize the Supreme Court can basically consider any issue that's presented by the facts and the law in the case. I argued in the letter brief that I didn't think the court should consider it because of the procedural status in that the state in this case more or less stipulated at the trial court level that the plea colloquy was deficient. But all of that, the procedural aspect of it aside, the second to the last line of Tovar is, we note, finally, that states are free to adopt by statute, rule, or decision any guides to the acceptance of an uncounseled plea they deem useful.
So you want us to stick with Pickens?
Exactly. I was going to say that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that the U.S. Supreme Court said we hold only that the two admonitions of the Iowa Supreme Court are not required by the federal Constitution. I've always been proud to practice law in Wisconsin because I think we've never settled for the bare minimum constitutional protections. And I think we should not consider overruling the requirement of Pickens because I have to respectfully disagree with some of the things that the U.S. Supreme Court said in Tovar. There's an undercurrent in Tovar that the importance of defense counsel in the beginning of a case isn't important. They give an example about how a lawyer is able to assist a defendant during the course of a jury trial, but what a lawyer has to offer in the beginning of a case isn't as important. And I completely disagree with that because at least once a week I tell a client of mine, I'm glad you hired me at this point because it is in the very beginning of the case where I can do the most good for you. In things such as decisions on what evidence to preserve, which motions to file.
Didn't Tovar really kind of distinguish, though, where it said that there's certain types of proceedings where it's not as important to go through this, and a guilty plea is one of those, but you have to look at the nature of the proceeding?
Yes, that's exactly what they said. They said the nature of the proceeding and the point in the proceeding. And right now I'm talking about that. I think it's as important in the very beginning of a case to have the – in fact, I could even make a persuasive argument. I think that it's more important to have counsel at the very beginning of a case than it is –
And while it may be, it's not as important with a guilty plea anymore, though, right?
Well, in my own opinion, if that's what you're asking, I do think it is important, but I do acknowledge what the Supreme Court said, that at the point of a guilty plea, the assistance of counsel isn't as important. And I'm explaining to the Wisconsin Supreme Court why I think you ought to afford the people of this state greater protection than the bare minimum that's talked about in Tovar. I think Pickens is the better law. I think it is very important that a defendant demonstrate that he is aware of the hazards and the intricacies of a proceeding pro se, and that's particularly true in a drunk driving case.
Now, is that fair? You want to talk about rights? Rights for who? Rights for your client? Rights for the citizens that are apprehended in this manner? So let's talk about a playing field. In using that argument, in Wisconsin, isn't there a proceeding set up under Klesic, under Bangert, where at least the state would have an opportunity to, when you raise the issue that I was not advised about my rights when I went pro se, that they could look into that? Otherwise, a person could simply plead that I did not know, and there'd be no opportunity for the state to go back.
Well, I think what you're getting to, Justice, is the difference between a direct attack and a collateral attack.
What is the difference?
Well, I think a direct attack is where the defendant, in the case where he has entered the guilty plea pro se, makes a motion to withdraw the plea and claims, I didn't know this was going to be as tricky as it turned out to be when I waived my right to counsel. And the first thing the court will do in that case is look back at the transcript and see what the colloquy said. If the colloquy was completely sufficient under Pickens, the defendant told the judge that he knew of all the hazards and the difficulties of proceeding pro se, he was doing this freely and voluntarily, that motion gets denied immediately without any further inquiry. It's only if the defendant on a direct attack makes that challenge, they look at the record of the plea hearing and they find out that it's deficient. The trial court judge didn't do what the Supreme Court told him or her to do as far as spreading out all of the factors on the record. Only if that happens, then do we get to this evidentiary hearing where we talk about the defendant or the defense counsel may be examined as to the circumstances of the waiver. I've conceded in my brief that there is a certain logic to the idea that on a direct attack, the defendant ought to be examined. The reason is he's already waived his right to remain silent in that case on the issue of his waiver of counsel. But when you move to a collateral attack, which is a different case, and I emphasize that because of exactly what the Fifth Amendment says, that in no criminal case may a person be compelled to testify against themselves where that testimony is incriminatory. So on a collateral attack, we are in a totally separate case. And there's some suggestion by the state in their brief that the testimony that's being elicited isn't incriminatory. And you just really need only to look at the facts of this case. Alan Ernst has pointed out that the plea colloquy contained in the record of his fourth offense is defective, and the trial court agreed that it's defective.
Well, okay, the trial court agreed, and that's why I raised the Tovar question. We know now that under the U.S. Supreme Court case, which is, I won't say on all fours, but very close, at least as far as the language, that is not necessary. So your argument is, well, that is true, but in Wisconsin we want greater rights, and therefore we still have to continue with Pickens.
Right. I think under Pickens it is necessary. The point that I was leading up to was that Ernst has claimed in this other criminal case that the plea colloquy was defective. If he doesn't testify in this case, his prior conviction will be struck. He'll be still facing a fourth offense, which contains a maximum only of a year in jail, whereas if he is called to testify in this case, there's the possibility that suddenly the judge will be able to find that he freely and voluntarily waived his right to counsel, and the case goes from a misdemeanor to a felony where he could potentially go to prison for 5 years.
Jensen, if I could, my understanding of the privilege against self-incrimination is that it attaches throughout the case and throughout the appellate process for that case. Now, if the appellate process has already run for the fourth offense, aren't you arguing that the privilege extends then beyond that appellate process if we're going to attach it to now the fifth offense?
Well, I'm arguing only that Ernst has a Fifth Amendment right in this present case to remain silent. And there is a case, State versus Pickens, that we've been discussing, and the victim and the defendant has raised that as a defense. And I think to call him to testify under compulsion concerning his knowledge of his waiver of counsel in that case incriminates him. And quite literally, it goes from being a misdemeanor to a felony, 1 year in jail to 5 years in prison potentially. To me, that certainly feels like incrimination. And I guess to maybe more squarely answer your question, I don't believe that if you waive your right to remain silent in one case, in this case the fourth offense drunk driving case, that you've now waived your Fourth Amendment right for all time, for all purposes in every single criminal case. Because that, I go back to the simplicity of the Fifth Amendment in any criminal case. I think you need to waive it in each case.
What is the procedure that you think could be followed here? You, the defendant is challenging the fourth conviction on grounds that there wasn't an adequate explanation of the right to counsel. And what should happen? Play it out for me.
Is this a collateral attack or a direct attack?
Collateral attack.
I think what should happen on a collateral attack is the defendant files a motion. He alleges in this motion that the record of the waiver of counsel colloquy in my prior case is defective under State versus Pickens. And I would guess it's, since the defendant has the burden of production in that circumstance, he would have to present the record of the plea hearing to the court. And then the court would look at that plea hearing. And if it is defective, if the judge in that case didn't do what the Supreme Court told him or her to do, it's defective. And it can't be used as evidence to enhance his penalty in the subsequent case. That's, I think, what the procedure ought to be.
So could the state retry the fourth offense?
That's a very interesting question, because I've heard of that actually being tried in some counties. Under these circumstances where the prosecutors alleged in the prior case that that constitutes some breach of the plea agreement and attempt to reopen it and cure the defect that way. And I have to admit that if a prosecutor were that ardent about resolving this issue, there is a certain amount of logic to going back in that case and reopening if that's what you're going to do. But I just don't think you ought to compel the defendant to incriminate himself in this present case.
Well, suppose the defendant were a prominent criminal defense attorney.
Okay.
And in fact, a plea was entered, but there was a defective explanation from the court. It would be a little hard for us to assume that this prominent criminal defense attorney didn't understand what was going on, didn't understand the right to counsel. Is that an element? Whether the defendant understands?
The answer is yes, because the State is entitled to this evidentiary hearing, and I think I even mentioned either in my Supreme Court brief or the Court of Appeals brief that there are all kinds of ways the State can circumstantially talk about the defendant's knowledge short of compelling his own testimony. For example, if in this case you're speaking of this hypothetical case, if they could introduce evidence extrinsic to the defendant's own testimony that he's handled 450 criminal jury trials, I think that would be fairly compelling evidence that he did have the knowledge and did know the dangers of proceeding pro se. But it would be done without calling this prominent defense lawyer as a witness to testify about his knowledge of criminal law.
How is the state going to prove if it isn't a prominent criminal defense attorney? How would we know whether the person had an understanding or not without asking him?
Well, they may not know, and the prior conviction may have to be struck. A similar question would be, how do we know that the defendant intended to kill the victim in a homicide case unless we can call the victim as a witness and ask him, what was your intent? It has to be proved circumstantially because of the Fifth Amendment, and if it can't be proved circumstantially, then the evidence is insufficient, and we've decided hundreds of years ago that it's better to let an occasional guilty person go free than it is to erode these rights that we have under the Fifth Amendment and the other amendments in the Bill of Rights.
So you don't think this is different? This is not different because there has been a plea, there's been a conviction. This is the question that Justice Butler asked you. You're saying that it's so important to keep the Fifth Amendment, but what I'm hearing here is that and I agree with that, but this is a little bit different in the sense that here this has been invoked by the defendant. This is an enhancer situation, and the state has no opportunity to get at the facts. And that's what we're talking about, going back and talking about testimony and the facts of this particular.
Well, I think there are a lot of analogies in criminal law. For example, during the course of a homicide trial, the defendant may, by some means, raise the issue of self-defense, which requires the state to then negative that beyond a reasonable doubt by circumstantial evidence. They cannot call the defendant and ask him, were you really trying to defend yourself against the victim's attack? I think that's an analogy. I mean, my opinion is what this boils down to is if the Supreme Court tells the circuit court that they're supposed to do something, you're supposed to conduct a certain kind of colloquy, and if you don't do it, then the conviction is invalid, at least for these purposes.
So if the court were to, so it's the procedure that you don't want to be used that produces the self-incrimination, and on the other hand, you don't want us to take a look at the U.S. Supreme Court case and just say, well, simply, well, we'll follow, as we generally do in criminal law, what the U.S. Supreme Court does. And here they specifically used, you don't want us to do that either.
Well, what I want the court to do is to not overrule Pickens because I think it's a good rule, and I explain the reasons why I think it's a good rule, because there are lots of pitfalls, hazards, and things like that that are not apparent to a defendant. And so even though the U.S. Supreme Court has said that that isn't absolutely required under the Sixth Amendment, I think Pickens is the better rule just because of my own personal experience in defending people in criminal cases. There are a lot of pitfalls, hazards, deadlines, things of that nature that a pro se person just is not aware of. And so I don't think I'm playing both sides of the fence here. I'm simply saying that I think Pickens is a better rule. I think that rule should be maintained because it's necessary to adequately protect people who propose to proceed without the assistance of an attorney. I'm also asking the Supreme Court to basically put some teeth into its pronouncements. If you tell the circuit court judges, this is what we want you to do, then they have to do it. And if they don't do it, then the consequence is that that conviction is invalid insofar as it's used to enhance a penalty in another case. And I think it's important to also mention that the reason why, and I'm looking for the exact citation right now, and I can't put my finger on it. Oh, in Baker, the reason why this was the Supreme Court created this rule of spreading the facts on the record is because an uncounseled conviction is unreliable. And so, in other words, the failure to have an attorney counsel you makes that unreliable as evidence. In this case, it would be evidence of prior bad behavior by the defendant used to enhance his penalty. So I hope I'm not playing both sides of the fence. I just think Pickens is the better rule. I think that if the circuit courts don't do what they're told to do by the Supreme Court, then the consequence is that conviction is unreliable, and we should not use an unreliable conviction in some other criminal case, and we shouldn't make that prior conviction more reliable by compelling the defendant to testify as to his knowledge of his waiver.
Mr. Jensen, pulling from the earlier case this morning, we heard about Arkansas versus Sullivan. We really don't have the authority, do we, to ignore the pronouncement of the United States Supreme Court in Iowa versus Tovar, right?
That's right, but I think that this court was given specific authorization, if you will, to make their own rule in Tovar.
But are you arguing under the United States Constitution, or are you arguing under the Wisconsin Constitution?
Well, I
don't think we can interpret the United States Constitution more broadly than the United States Supreme Court does.
Right, and I haven't specifically quoted into the record the Wisconsin Constitution. I've talked about the Fifth Amendment in the federal Constitution, but I think the language is practically identical, if I recall, in the Wisconsin Constitution. And yes, I think the Supreme Court of Wisconsin is authorized to more broadly interpret the meaning of that. And that's why I think Pickens is the better rule, because I think it does offer greater protection under both constitutions.
Let me ask you one other question.
Sure.
Your client is bringing the action. It kind of reminds me of a situation similar to when a defendant would appeal an action. And with the exception of sufficiency of the evidence and certain statutory preserved rights, if you file an appeal, the thrust of being the proponent of the appeal is that you give up any double jeopardy claims should you prevail on an appeal. Isn't this something similar? You're asking to go back and challenge an earlier conviction. By bringing that challenge, do you somehow give up your privilege in order to take advantage of the challenge that's available to you?
I don't think so, because you're only saying that the state's evidence, in this case evidence of his prior bad behavior and being convicted of a fourth offense drunk driving, is unreliable. It's invalid. And if it is unreliable and invalid, and under Pickens it seems to be, then it should not be used to enhance his penalty. And that's as far as the challenge goes.
But you don't know if it's unreliable unless you hear from your client, and your client is invoking a privilege that keeps the question from being asked.
Yes.
So I guess my question once again is, since he is the one challenging collaterally the earlier conviction, if he wants to prevail on that challenge, isn't he somehow, or should he be giving up his right to invoke that privilege? Is there some kind of a waiver argument here is what I'm getting at?
I don't think so, because all the defendant is suggesting when he files a motion like that is that the state's evidence is unreliable. I think an analogy is, for example, if a defendant in a criminal case files a motion saying, the search of my house for my wallet was warrantless, and so I move to suppress all evidence. And the starting point is that a warrantless search is per se unreasonable. And I don't think the defendant gives up his right to remain silent concerning the circumstances of this search. It's incumbent upon the state to establish what was the reasonable suspicion or what was the probable cause for the search. And a defendant, by seeking to suppress evidence, hasn't waived his right to remain silent. And I think a person who suggests that the state's evidence is unreliable because it was an uncounseled conviction likewise shouldn't be compelled to incriminate himself.
The burden of proof on whether or not there was an understanding here.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I will acknowledge that in Tovar there is a statement which I take to be talking about Iowa law, where it says that we acknowledge or we concede that the defendant has the burden of proof. And my understanding, and when I saw that, I looked at Baker again, and
it was cite to Iowa, Watts v. State.
Right.
And it was a concession by the defendant, Tovar.
Yes. So I took that to mean at least be limited to Iowa law, at least I hope so, because then I looked at Baker again, and I didn't find anything in there about the defendant having anything more than the burden of production, because it says he needs to file and allege.
Okay. And what does he have to allege?
I think he needs to allege that the plea colloquy was defective.
Does he have to allege that he didn't understand the charge or the range of punishment?
If you follow the State's inference upon assumption upon inference, yes, you can come to that conclusion because they hearken back to the Bangert situation. But I think that we should distinguish between a direct attack and a collateral attack. Bangert involved a direct attack, and as I've conceded, if you've started to give up your rights in that criminal case, it makes sense to ask you to further explain it.
So is your position that the only allegation he has to make is that the colloquy wasn't adequate on the record and that it's up to the State to prove that he voluntarily and intelligently waived counsel?
Right. The first question the trial court judge would do is look at the transcript. If it is defective, if it's adequate, then we don't do anything. The motion gets denied. If it is defective, then the judge ought to conduct a hearing to find out whether it's likely the defendant did have the knowledge. And it would be the things that Justice Prosser talked about. If the State could produce evidence that the defendant is a criminal defense lawyer, I think the trial court would be justified in finding circumstantially that he should have understood the pitfalls.
So we could have this hearing. The only objection you have is that your client wouldn't have to testify, right?
That is exactly right.
Well, what about using the Blunt case? I think it's a court of appeals out of the state of Washington that said, well, you can infer negatively the silence of the defendant.
Well, and I think even the state
and Washington. Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say that I think even the state acknowledges that really is just the flip side of the same coin. If you can draw a negative inference from somebody remaining silent, it's the same thing as compelling testimony. And I think that implicates the Fifth Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Michael C. Sanders, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, I think that the State's view of this case is not exactly the same. It is the State's position that this Court can and should decide this case without reaching the issue certified by the Court of Appeals. The State asked the Court to instead adopt the holding of Iowa v. Tovar and apply it to this case, and to recognize that the record in this case, viewed in light of Tovar, does not show a constitutional violation of Ernst's right to counsel in his 2002 conviction. The Court does not need to reach the Sixth Amendment issue because that issue explicitly concerns the privilege against self-incrimination in the context of a collateral attack when the record shows a constitutionally invalid waiver of counsel. Because there was no constitutional violation in this case, there can be no collateral attack. So there really is no question about whether he can plead the Fifth.
What about your opposing counsel's argument that, look, we have the Pickens case, and why don't we follow that? Why shouldn't we?
The Court can. I don't think there is any problem with that case, except that it does not apply in the context of a guilty plea, as I think is made very clear in Tovar, if the what I think that case stands for is that under the U.S. Constitution, the court only has to do three things. It has to tell the defendant, or it has to make sure that, or yes, it has to tell the defendant that he does have the right to an attorney in the plea process. It has to tell him how much time he could face, and it has to tell him what the state has to prove. But those are the only three things that the court has to do in all cases in the context of a plea. The court did say on the last page that states can apply guidelines, rules, or do anything like that if they choose to. And this court, I think, has. And other than in the context of a plea, it can and should keep that same rule. I think that in Tovar, the court said that when a pro se defendant is going to trial, the court still has to tell him about the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation. And I don't think that based on that, that the state rule has to fail.
Counsel, should we agree with you and say that Tovar changes the context in which we took this case? Shouldn't we ask you to brief that issue and ask a defense counsel to brief it?
Sure. Yes, if that's what the court wants to do, I would be pleased. Issue.
Okay. And then your view is that Tovar really just undercuts the certified issue.
Mm-hmm.
It just settles the law under federal constitutional law.
Yes.
And would be wasteful for us to ignore Tovar as a matter of judicial economy.
Yes.
Why shouldn't we take the position that our state demands more, and that when we do a guilty plea, that the colloquy should indicate the ramifications of not having a counsel?
I think that the court can do that in the sense of a state rule, that's what courts have to do. And if that's the case, and a court fails to comply with that rule, a defendant can attack, but it cannot be a collateral attack, because those can only be on constitutional grounds, specifically the constitutional ground of the denial of the right to counsel. And under Hahn and Custis, such an attack cannot be brought on the lack of compliance with the state rule. So in this case, I think we get back to the same point, that even if the court wants to say that the court failed to do one of those four things and that by a state rule it had to, it doesn't really matter in this case because he can't attack it here.
But couldn't we keep Pickens under Article 1, Section 8 of the Wisconsin Constitution? It doesn't just have to be under court rule.
Well, the court could do that. I don't know of any times when the court has done that in the sense of the right to, in the sense of the constitutional right to an attorney. In State v. Klessig, the court said that when it comes to the right to the assistance of counsel, the right under the state constitution is the same as the right under the U.S. Constitution. I'm not sure that that's completely accurate, but in terms of what it takes to waive counsel, I don't think that there is any difference between the two, and that if the U.S. Constitution now is going to be interpreted as it is, then the state constitution should say the same thing. If you did want to look at that ground, I would brief that too, obviously.
Let me ask you if I could. I was a little surprised that neither party cited in your briefs a case that I think may have some bearing on the procedural aspect of this case, Park, P-A-R-K-E, versus Raley, R-A-L-E-Y, United States Supreme Court opinion interpreting Kentucky.
Yes.
And the procedure involving the presumption of, or no presumption against waiver from a silent record. Well, the court in that case said that that presumption goes out the window on habeas corpus. This is a collateral attack. I'm confused why you weren't arguing that here.
Well, in our brief, we didn't. Here, I plan to. Again, this
okay.
is something.
All right. I'll wait.
Again, the way that the court views this case has changed a great deal in the last 2 weeks. And at the time, I didn't realize what that case would mean to this one and what it would mean to the law. And now I think I might. And I think that it does cast a lot of doubt on the way that these attacks are done in the state. And that it seems to me that from what Park said, if there isn't anything in the record which shows that the defendant, well, if he can't point to something that says here's where the court failed, here's what didn't occur, the state or the court should then view that as a presumption that the conviction in the prior case is good. He basically has to prove that it's not. And in lots of these cases where you might have a conviction from some other state, or you may have one which is just older and has been lost, or in this state where at one point these had been thrown out because you can only count back a certain number of years. In those types of cases where the state may not be able to actually come up with anything which explains whether this guy had a lawyer or waived it properly, what that case says is in those cases the defendant really has to prove it. And that actually brings me back to something else you brought up. It seems to me that in that context, if he has to prove it, he has to really explain what it is that the court didn't do in his past case. And by doing so, I think he then waives his right not to take the stand if the state wants to question him.
Maybe I'm picking with your words, but does the defendant have to explain what the court didn't do? The record already shows what the court didn't do. Or isn't it that the defendant has to come in and allege that he did not understand?
Well, I think he has to do.
The record is blank. If the advice was not given, the advice was not given. But the issue
yes.
is whether there was a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver, right?
Yes, my words were not clear.
Okay.
And at that point, I think he then does waive his right to plead the Fifth. And I'm not certain, but I think that might be why there isn't much case law on this topic. Because in general, if you're going to bring this type of claim, you have to explain what it was that you didn't know, what it was that didn't occur, that meant that when you waived counsel, you didn't do it in a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary manner. And once you do that, you then can be asked about it. I think there is case law that says that when you raise something like that, you can't then go partway and stop and not take any questions and explain.
Counsel, when I asked Attorney Jensen the question, the difference between direct and collateral, he pretty much indicated, well, it's not on direct. I'm talking about giving the state an opportunity to go back and have this so-called classic Bangert Hahn Custis hearing.
Mm-hmm.
In a collateral attack, he said that, I think he said that, look, that conviction is part of the state's evidence, and what the defendant says when he testifies may subject him to new liability. Here he said, well, look, the guy's looking at 5 years. Now, you seem to indicate that there is a difference. Strike that. that there is not a difference, and that certainly because the defendant is making this, that the state is does not have any weaponry to go back or even to, other than the bald face, I was not represented, I was not properly represented, therefore the fourth conviction does not, is not appropriate to be used in an enhancer. Tell me the difference. Why could we use a collateral attack here and still say there's not a violation of the Fifth Amendment?
Well, I think that to put it into context, collateral attacks are disfavored in the law because there is a presumption that any judgment which was not challenged on appeal or where the appeal lost is good. And so what a person is really doing in that type of an attack is trying to go back and not really argue the whole case again or not really say that I didn't mean to say that exactly, but it's not exactly the same thing. He's not trying to get out of the prior conviction exactly. He's just trying to say that that shouldn't count for some other reason. But that gets to the presumption that any conviction which wasn't challenged is still good. In this case, I don't think it's really true that the state needs to prove that the prior conviction was good and that his rights were waived in a constitutional manner. All the state has to prove is, in this case, that he drove and he did it while he was either under the influence of an intoxicant for the OWI charge, or that he drove while with a prohibited alcohol concentration, and that there were three priors. But that part of it, even the state doesn't have to prove that the three priors were all good, or that he actually waived his right to counsel, or that he actually had an attorney. It just has to prove that he actually has three priors. And the state can do that by just showing with the judgments of conviction that he does have three priors. So it's really not a portion of what the state has to prove. It only becomes something that the state has to deal with because he collaterally attacked.
Sanders, if I could, I want to go back to Tovar for a moment and exactly how far you see Tovar is going. Tovar talks a lot about Patterson versus Illinois. As far as I can tell, it does not reverse Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
So it would seem clear that at least in a trial setting under Tovar, the judge would still have to advise the defendant of the pitfalls of proceeding without an attorney. You would agree with that?
Yes.
What about motions to suppress evidence?
It's not completely clear where this case leaves things. I'm not certain. And all I have made of it is that in the one place when a pro se defendant goes to trial, the court does have to tell him about the difficulties and disadvantages about the pitfalls. When he's pleading guilty, the court doesn't have to tell him. Other than that, I'm not completely certain where things fall with. But what the court does say is that, I think not counting those two things, the court then has to look at case-specific factors to determine what types of warnings might be required in any given context.
As I read Tovar, it says, Patterson describes a pragmatic approach to the waiver question, one that asks what purposes a lawyer can serve at a particular stage mm-hmm. of proceedings and questions. So you really have to look at the stage of the proceedings and what assistance, as they go on to say, that an attorney could provide to an accused at that stage. Is that correct?
Yes.
So in other words, Pickens may or may not still be valid with respect to pretrial suppression motions, other pretrial proceedings. All Tovar says is that if the guilty plea stage, mm-hmm. we no longer have to do this. Is that correct?
To the extent that it's a state rule, I think it
I'm
can still...
I'm talking about under the United States Constitution.
Okay. Well, I'm not completely certain that I got the last part of that then.
My understanding is that what Tovar says is that in the context of the guilty plea
mm-hmm.
setting, that you really don't have to go through and explain in detail all the pitfalls.
Right.
And they discuss it in broad terms of pretrial type proceedings, but then they say, we're going to look at the nature of the pretrial proceeding. This case is really just limited at this point, at least under the United States interpretation, to a guilty plea setting, correct?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
This was a guilty plea setting?
He was... Yes, yes. In his fourth, he pled. And that's the one that is being attacked in this case.
Could you summarize for me if there were a hearing, as the trial court requested, and Mr. Ernst was called on to testify, why doesn't that violate the Fifth Amendment? What is there that doesn't violate the Fifth Amendment?
Well, he's not being asked to testify about anything that he actually did wrong, about any portion of the crime, about anything that the state has to prove. It's not even about this case. It's just about what he knew some years back when he pled guilty to a different charge. The state, in Blunt, the court, I think, found that the state could even use what they asked the what they asked Blunt to prove the fact of the prior conviction. Here, the state isn't even asking for that. It doesn't need to prove the fact. It really only needs to show what he knew when he was pleading guilty. I don't have a great answer as to why that doesn't violate the Fifth, but I just can't think of any way that it does.
If we were to say that it did violate the Fifth and he didn't have to testify...
If we were to say that...
If we were to say exactly what Mr. Jensen wants, that this violates the Fifth Amendment and he cannot be called to testify, how would you prove that the dialogue, the colloquy here is, the court says, is it your wish to proceed here today without counsel? Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel that that's a decision that you have made of your own volition? It was a hard decision, yes. It was, but yes. All right, now how would you prove, if you can't call him, that he didn't know what he was doing, didn't know the implications?
I think that's a fine question. I'm not really certain. I'm not certain if you would call the judge from the prior case or an attorney. I mean, I don't think so. But I'm not really certain how you would prove it if you can't ask him, essentially, or if he's not required to put in a little something more when he moves to strike his prior conviction.
Well, who has to prove what at this stage?
Well, all he has to do with is show that he has to make a prima facie showing that his right to counsel was not constitutionally waived, or that he didn't have counsel, or that his right was not constitutionally waived.
But he didn't have counsel, right, in the fourth. He did not
right.
have counsel.
Yes.
And he was given various instructions about pleading guilty without counsel or with counsel, but not given a full panoply. Isn't that what happened here?
Yes. Yeah. The court spoke of three. It didn't speak of the fourth.
All right. So he shows that. He brings in the record, he brings in the transcript, and he shows defective colloquy. No counsel. Your position is that's not enough. Is that right?
Well, to meet the first step, I think that that's fine. He should be forced to explain what it was that he didn't know, and what it was that, because in this case, he's, you know, this was his fourth. He's got a long, long list of past cases. He's had attorneys. He hasn't had attorneys. It would seemingly be, I guess I don't think it wouldn't be fair to expect him to at least explain something about what it was that he didn't know.
Well, under Tovar, they say, at least citing an Iowa case, that it was the defendant's burden to prove that he didn't competently and intelligently waive his right to the assistance of counsel. Do you think that's the law in Wisconsin? And if so, of course, I'll ask you for a citation.
That's why I guess I'm going to have to say no. Or I'm going to have to say I don't know. I haven't been able to find anything along those lines.
Doesn't Klessig say just the opposite, that once the prima facie showing has been made, that the state then has to prove voluntariness by clear and convincing evidence?
Yes.
Well, was Klessig collateral or direct? So in direct, you concede that the burden of proof is on the state.
Yes.
And assuming that's true, then how does the state prove their case other than to have some type of hearing?
In the sense of a collateral attack or in a direct attack?
No, collateral.
I'm not exactly sure.
So, I mean, the answer is obvious. They can't go any further, and so the defendant, and I'll ask your opposing counsel, can make this defense, which he knows is unassailable by the state.
I think so. I think that that's what the court in this case found, that he was going to, that he just found it fair for the state to at least have a chance to ask him about this, because in a case like this, he's not claiming that he didn't know what he was doing. He's not claiming that he didn't have a lot of experience with lawyers and not having lawyers. He's not claiming anything along those lines. He's only claiming that the court failed to do one thing that this court has said it must do. But he's not going, but he just isn't going to give the court any more.
Well, the trial court, and I'm just looking at the blue brief on, in the appendix, page 11, said that he thought that to rule that the defendant cannot be called makes the Baker procedure meaningless. And I think your opposing counsel talked about Baker. What about Baker?
Well, I think what the court said here is true, that if the court doesn't really have an opportunity to ask him questions, then I really don't know what the court would put or what the state would put on in order to try to prove this.
So really, when we talk about having some type of hearing under Klessig or Bangert or Baker, or you really wouldn't have one unless the court were to say that in this case either the Fifth Amendment does or does not apply. Obviously, if it does, then there wouldn't be any hearing because he can't be compelled to testify, period.
That might be true. That might be true.
In a case involving questions about the validity of a plea, isn't the prima facie case an allegation that something was defective about the plea colloquy and that the defendant didn't understand?
I think that that's what it should be. I'm not certain under the state cases if that's what it says. I could be wrong.
Well,
I may have forgotten.
That's what I recall writing last term in the Hampton case.
Then I'm wrong.
Counsel?
Then I suppose we should have cited that.
Yes.
No.
Counsel, with regard to the constitutional amendment, the constitutional amendment, the Fifth Amendment says, what does it say? Nor shall any person be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. And I think the Wisconsin language is pretty similar. Nor shall any person be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself or herself. And you're reading that they cannot be compelled to be a witness against themselves in that case, vis-a-vis that case. I mean, because if you just look at it, the words, Now I'm getting to direct and collateral. That's my point. If you just look at the words, nor shall any person be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Well, seems like this is a criminal case where he's being a witness against himself at this evidentiary hearing, because if he testifies, he's probably going to say he understands. He understood.
I'm not sure, but maybe.
You know. So assuming that that's what his testimony would be. So why isn't that violative? Nor shall he can be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself.
Well, I don't know of any court which has held that, which has ever said that in this context, that asking him a question not about what he's done or a crime or anything along those lines, or even any of the facts of his prior case, or even that he was convicted in his prior case, really incriminates him, really does anything to make it so that he's more likely to be found guilty in this case. It's really just a matter of what type of a penalty he's going to get. It's not a matter of guilt or innocence. It's not criminal liability of any kind.
Yeah, but that's reading all of that into those words. Those words don't have all of that. Those words just say, can't make him testify against himself.
I guess I would just leave it at, I don't know of any other court which has held that in this context.
Taken such a literal interpretation.
Well, may I ask, defendants sometimes make statements against their own interest, and then they try to suppress those statements.
Mm-hmm.
Miranda Goodchild hearing. Okay. Is that a precedent that the state should be relying on, or is that distinguishable because defendants are called on to testify at those hearings?
Well, I mean, I guess I think it's the same type of thing where what he says there isn't going to be used against him in the case, and here what he says isn't really going to be used against him in his newer case. If he says that he knew why he should have a lawyer or why he didn't need a lawyer or anything like that in the prior case, the state isn't technically going to use that here. It's using it only to try to counter his attack on the prior, but it really doesn't have a great deal to do with the new case. I'm not sure if I answered that. I guess if that's all the questions, then in closing, I'm not quite sure if I'm closing. Excuse me for just a moment. I guess I just want to get back to my first point, which is that based on the U.S. Supreme Court case and its holding in Tovar, I think that this court really should find that under the U.S. Constitution, Ernst has not shown, and the record in this case has not shown, any constitutional violation of his right to counsel. He therefore, while he may have had a claim, had he brought it on direct attack under a Wisconsin rule, he cannot bring it under the U.S. Constitution because of Hahn and Custis. At that point, because he cannot attack, there really isn't, the court need not reach the Fifth Amendment issue, and I think that's all I have to say.
Relying on Tabor.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Jensen, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
The first point I want to address very quickly is this idea that that Mr. Ernst is not basing his collateral attack on a constitutional issue, but rather on a state rule. The constitutional requirement is under the Sixth Amendment that a person in a criminal case is entitled to counsel. What Pickens talks about is what proof needs to be in the record to prove a valid waiver. And if the proof is not there, we go back to the default position that he was denied his constitutional right to counsel. So Ernst is not relying upon some mere state rule, for example, the statutory speedy trial law, in order to invalidate his prior conviction.
What are you relying on then?
I'm relying on the fact that Pickens required that proof be made in a certain way, that this person waived his constitutional right. The proof is insufficient, and therefore the default position is...
Based on what authority?
Based on what Pickens says, that this is what you need to do.
I mean, what constitutional peg are you arguing?
The Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
But the Sixth Amendment has been interpreted differently.
Well, that is true. As I was sitting there listening to Mr. Sanders, I was rereading Tovar because it occurred to me that really the default position is that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is violated if you didn't prove a valid waiver. So what needs to be – are you really arguing about the denial of the right to counsel or the proof? And my opinion is you're arguing in this situation about the validity of the proof of the waiver. And if the proof is insufficient, we go back to the idea he was denied his right to counsel. Now, Mr. Sanders argues that he doesn't believe there was anything incriminatory about what Ernst might be called to testify about. And I've already explained in my first remarks why I think it would be incriminatory, but there's nothing – innocuous testimony can be very incriminatory. For example, a person's name and address may at first blush seem to be completely innocuous. Why wouldn't he want to give us his name and address? But it could be extremely incriminatory if the police had found kilograms of cocaine at that address. He's now proved the state's element of possession, or at least gone a long way towards it. So I don't think you can look at what Mr. Ernst may or may not testify to in interpreting the Fifth Amendment. It's really in the context of the proof of the case.
Mr. Jensen, I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Sanders. Who's got the burden of proof in this collateral attack? If you look at 97406 sub 6, if this were indeed a collateral attack post-conviction, the proceedings under this section shall be considered civil in nature, and the burden of proof shall be upon the person. You're doing it not by way of 97406. You're not collaterally contesting the conviction before the court that entered the conviction, but you're collaterally attacking it at the proceeding in the new case.
Right.
Who has what burden?
Well, I can't remember if it was in my Court of Appeals brief or if it was an argument I made that I scrapped, but I talked about that it's kind of unfortunate that we have no better word for this than collateral attack, because it's not a collateral attack like we have in 97406, which is an attack outside the regular procedures. We're not really trying to reopen this. And it's not, in my opinion, truly a collateral attack. It's just alleging that the state's evidence of prior conduct is unreliable. And so I understand the question, and my answer is it may be a semantic question, because in my opinion this is not truly a collateral attack in the way we...
Counsel, I don't quite understand that. When there was a court proceeding, there was findings by the court, he made a plea, and there was a finding of guilty, and the sentence was assessed. So that's done.
Yes.
Now to go back, you're saying it's not... So it isn't a direct attack, and it's not a collateral attack. Is this a new type of attack?
Well, yes, I think it is a new type of attack, and that's why perhaps the court didn't have a better word to use for it, since it's new, and they called it a collateral attack. But, for example, a habeas corpus is an attack on the conviction, saying you can't confine me anymore.
Well, this isn't a habeas corpus.
Right, but I think that's what Justice Butler was citing from, was the idea in 97406 is a similar procedure to the federal habeas corpus procedure. But those are really directly attacking the underlying conviction, and this is something different. It's attacking the reliability of the state's evidence of prior bad conduct.
Why isn't it your burden to establish that the earlier conviction was somehow tainted?
Well, it is our burden of production. We need to file a motion and meet this initial showing that the plea colloquy is defective. And once that's done, the burden of proof then shifts to the State to prove by evidence which isn't privileged under the Fifth Amendment that the defendant may have knowingly and voluntarily understood the pitfalls of proceeding pro se. And in closing, then, I think I would just like to quote again from Miranda that those who framed our Constitution in the Bill of Rights were ever aware of the subtle encroachments on individual liberty. They knew that illegitimate and unconstitutional practices get their footing by silent approaches and slight deviations from legal modes of procedure. And I just fear that if we accept the State's position in this case, by the time these high school students graduate from law school, we'll be in here arguing about whether a defendant in a criminal case should be called to testify about his waiver of his rights at a Miranda Goodchild hearing. And I think the state of the Fifth Amendment law has got to the point that the Sixth Amendment law was before Crawford versus Washington. And Justice Bradley called it a literal interpretation, but I think that's what we ought to do, is give the Fifth Amendment the plain meaning of its words.
Could I ask one factual question? The fourth offense, there was a 100-day sentence. I assume by the time of the fifth offense, that had been served. What about the $4,367 fine? Had that been paid before the fifth?
I don't have an answer to that. Mr. Ernst has a different a trial court lawyer. I don't really know whether that's been paid or not.
Suppose it hadn't been paid.
Has not. Okay.
No, suppose, I don't know. Suppose it had not been paid.
Okay.
What would have been the effect of a successful motion on your part?
Is this a successful motion to withdraw his plea or the collateral attack we're arguing about here?
Your collateral attack.
It would have no effect on it. Because the attack here today only has to do with the reliability of that evidence for use in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen, and thank you, Mr. Sanders, for your argument on this case. I will now close the hearing on 03-1728-CR State versus Ernst. The students should remain in the courtroom, and Justice Rogensack will be out shortly to speak with them. And the court will reconvene at 1:30 for our third case today.